Why do humans not support and reward the more young than average age humans that like science education and learning? Humans that like science should be promoted and supported. In all parts of the planet Earth, humans go to schools and learn science. But look at the most popular humans. Most popular humans do not care for science. Clothes and tools. I am still trying to make a movie called Science. The stories of science are the best stories ever told of on life of Earth. A movie of science will make the movie The Ten Commandments look like a story of myth, full of obviously false events. Humans continue to use the products of science with no interest in the origin of all the products that make life more easy for all humans. People have nothing but hate and anger for science. Nobody can even say the word science. But people enjoy the products of science. People enjoy the ovens, the refrigerators, the drugs, and tools of science.
There has been a spacecraft sighted, flying high above. Yes, I will kiss the girl from Venus for science. Let's get those missiles ready to destroy the universe!
Learning to speak science. I recently spent 2.5 months during a book tour across the United States speaking about political attacks on science. At universities from Caltech to Oberlin, I heard a recurring series of questions from my audiences. How can scientists combat the political distortion of scientists? How can they defend evolution? How can they win back America and better translate what they know for the public? These aren't easy questions to answer, since they go beyond hard and fast matters of scientific accuracy and into the more nebulous realm of political communication and strategy. So, over the course of my travels, I began to formulate my response, mindful of the conditions that have prompted such a political awakening among scientists in the first place. What the scientific community is realizing is that scientific knowledge itself is politically vulnerable. We've seen the Bush administration's assaults on science, on issues ranging from climate change to Plan B emergency contraception. We're witnessing a newly resurgent anti-evolutionist movement that's spreading community to community and state to state. And we're frustrated with a national media that seeks to hear
both sides,
even on subjects where no scientific debate actually exists. Coming to grips with science's newly exposed political and cultural vulnerability will require scientists to emphasize a rather different set of skills than they're used to privileging. Although it's not true of all scientists, too many have grown accustomed to the security of their labs and university communities, occasionally lamenting the American public's poor understanding of science, but doing little in a concerted way to improve it. And small wonder, American science rewards the publication of peer-reviewed research, but offers little incentive for scientists to communicate and translate what they know to the public. So scientists in the U.S. have little practice when it comes to crafting a message or winning a political debate, and their inexperience sometimes leads to ill-advised actions that have the tendency to backfire. What defenders of science must realize if we want to combat political attacks effectively is that we have much to learn about political communication and strategizing. Ideally, and in the best spirit of science, we should view the current political quandary as a problem to be addressed through trial and error, empirical attempts to determine what actually works when it comes to translating science for the general public. Ironically, followers of regular politics are catching on to something that doesn't seem to have dawned on most scientists yet. It's actually possible to study empirically which public communication strategies work and which don't. It's even becoming possible to craft a communication strategy that's based on a rich understanding of how the human mind actually operates. One that, if properly executed by scientists and their supporters, could help rescue scientific integrity in America while better informing the American public. If we want to defend the knowledge that science has brought into the world, perhaps we should consider drawing upon the talents of researchers, social and cognitive scientists, who have brought empirical methods to bear on the study of effective political communication itself. Facts alone aren't enough to educate people. Instead, facts must be carefully packaged in the context of narratives or explanations if they're to enhance knowledge. Consider the technically complex issue of climate change, where attacks on science have been rampant and the public has been deeply confused. As an explanation, the greenhouse effect simply confuses people. Few Americans have any first-hand experience of greenhouses, and they don't grasp the proposed analogy between carbon dioxide and glass walls. So, instead, talking about a carbon dioxide blanket encircling the Earth can help people understand why a heating effect is taking place. Sure, it's a metaphor and should not be taken literally, but then so was the concept of an ozone hole, a phrasing that instantly allowed the public to understand the issue of ozone depletion, and that helped to galvanize political action. These are just a few suggestions from communication experts who are themselves scientists, and whose work is oriented toward finding scientifically tested solutions. Their empirical approach to communication ought to be second nature to scientists more generally, and to those of us who care about science, but it isn't. To be sure, most scientists have figured out how to communicate to their classes, or to explain their work at dinner parties, but the American public doesn't have the same level of background knowledge, or the same attention span. It learns in sound bites, in brief snippets at best. Those of us who care about science had better learn to address and win over this audience, and not just on specific issues like evolution and climate change. We must also explain the nature of the scientific method and the societal importance of scientific knowledge. One of the biggest explanatory holes that's waiting to be filled by somebody is, what is the role of science in a democracy? Notes Cultural Logic's Joseph Grady. It's a massive challenge, but then so was every other challenge that scientists have faced. Luckily, the scientific method has led to spectacular success. Now we must apply that method to the greatest and most crucial challenge of all, teaching the American public.
I'm trapped in a late 20th century traffic jam.
Bill Nye the Science Guy is brought to you by The Elevator. When you need to move up, just push the button.
Oh, scientists, say it ain't so. A new study has concluded that prayer has no medical benefit. Uncontrolled prayers from families and friends may have altered the results. Way to hold the study to the highest scientific standards, guys.
are typically defined as traditional views, fables, legends, or stories. As such, myths can be entertaining and even educational since they help people to make sense of the world. In fact, the explanatory role of myths most likely accounts for their development, spread, and persistence. However, when fact and fiction blur, myths lose their entertainment value and serve only to block full understanding. Such is the case with the myths of science. Myth number one. Hypotheses become theories, which become laws. This myth deals with the general belief that with increased evidence there is a developmental sequence through which scientific ideas pass on their way to final acceptance. Many believe that scientific ideas pass through the hypothesis and theory stages and finally mature as laws. The problem created by the false hierarchical nature inherent in this myth is that theories and laws are very different kinds of knowledge. Of course, there is a relationship between laws and theories, but one simply does not become the other, no matter how much empirical evidence is amassed. Laws are generalizations, principles, or patterns in nature, and theories are the explanations of those generalizations. Myth 2. A hypothesis is an educated guess. The definition of the term hypothesis has taken on an almost mantra-like life of its own in science classes. If a hypothesis is always an educated guess, as students typically assert, the question remains, an educated guess about what? The best answer for this question must be that without a clear view of the context in which the term is used, it is impossible to tell. The term hypothesis has at least three definitions, and for that reason should be abandoned, or at least used with caution. For instance, when Newton said that he framed no hypothesis as to the cause of gravity, he was saying that he had no speculation about an explanation of why the law of gravity operates as it does. In this case, Newton used the term hypothesis to represent an immature theory. A solution to the hypothesis problem suggested that tentative or trial laws be called generalizing hypotheses, with provisional theories referred to as explanatory hypotheses. Another approach would be to abandon the word hypothesis altogether in favor of terms such as speculative law or speculative theory. With evidence, generalizing hypotheses may become laws, and speculative theories may become theories, but under no circumstances do theories become laws. Finally, when students are asked to propose a hypothesis during a laboratory experience, the term now means a prediction. As for those hypotheses that are really forecasts, perhaps they should simply be called what they are, predictions. Myth 3. A general and universal scientific method exists. The notion that a common series of steps is followed by all research scientists must be among the most pervasive myths of science, given the appearance of such a list in the introductory chapters of many pre-college science texts. One of the reasons for the widespread belief in a general scientific method may be the way in which results are presented for publication in research journals. The standardized style makes it appear that scientists follow a standard research plan. Philosophers of science who have studied scientists at work have shown that no research method is applied universally. Close inspection will reveal that scientists approach and solve problems with imagination, creativity, prior knowledge, and perseverance. These, of course, are the same methods used by all problem solvers. The lesson to be learned is that science is no different from other human endeavors when puzzles are investigated. Fortunately, this is one myth that may eventually be displaced, since many newer texts are abandoning or augmenting the list in favor of discussions of methods of science. Myth 4. Evidence accumulated carefully will result in sure knowledge. All investigators, including scientists, collect and interpret empirical evidence through the process called induction. This is a technique by which individual pieces of evidence are collected and examined until a law is discovered or a theory is invented. Useful as this technique is, even a preponderance of evidence does not guarantee the production of valid knowledge because of what is called the problem of induction. It is both impossible to make all observations pertaining to a given situation and illogical to secure all relevant facts for all time, past, present, and future. However, only by making all relevant observations throughout all time could one say that a final valid conclusion had been made. This is the problem of induction. Scientists formulate laws and theories that are supposed to hold true in all places and for all time, but the problem of induction makes such a guarantee impossible. If we set aside the problem of induction momentarily, there is still the issue of how scientists make the final leap from the mass of evidence to the conclusion. In an idealized view of induction, the accumulated evidence will simply result in the production of a new law or theory in a procedural or mechanical fashion. In reality, there is no such method. The issue is far more complex than that. The final creative leap from evidence to scientific knowledge is the focus of another myth of science. Myth 5. Science and its methods provide absolute proof. The general success of the scientific endeavor suggests that its products must be valid. However, a hallmark of scientific knowledge is that it is subject to revision when new information is presented. Tentativeness is one of the points that differentiates science from other forms of knowledge. Accumulated evidence can provide support, validation, and substantiation for a law or theory, but will never prove those laws and theories to be true. The problem of induction argues against proof in science, though there is another element of this myth worth exploring. In actuality, the only truly conclusive knowledge produced by science results when a notion is falsified. What this means is that no matter what scientific idea is considered, once evidence begins to accumulate, at least we know that the notion is untrue. Myth 6. Science is more procedural than creative. We accept that no single guaranteed method of science can account for the success of science, but realize that induction, the collection and interpretation of individual facts providing the raw materials for laws and theories, is at the foundation of most scientific endeavors. This awareness brings with it a paradox. If induction itself is not a guaranteed method for arriving at conclusions, how do scientists develop useful laws and theories? Induction makes use of individual facts that are collected, analyzed, and examined. Some observers may perceive a pattern in these data and propose a law in response, but there is no logical or procedural method by which the pattern is suggested. With a theory, the issue is much the same. Only the creativity of the individual scientist permits the discovery of laws and the invention of theories. If there truly was a single scientific method, two individuals with the same expertise could review the same facts and reach identical conclusions. There is no guarantee of this because the range and nature of creativity is a personal attribute. Unfortunately, many common science teaching orientations and methods serve to work against the creative element in science. The majority of laboratory exercises, for example, are verification activities. Not only is this approach the antithesis of the way in which science actually operates, but such a portrayal must seem dry, clinical, and uninteresting to many students. Myth 7. Science and its methods can answer all questions. Philosophers of science have found it useful to refer to Karl Popper's belief that only those ideas that are potentially falsifiable are scientific ideas. For instance, the law of gravity states that more massive objects exert a stronger gravitational attraction than do objects with less mass when distance is held constant. This is a scientific law because it could be falsified if newly discovered objects operate differently with respect to gravitational attraction. In contrast, the core idea among creationists is that species were placed on Earth fully formed by some supernatural entity. Obviously, there is no scientific method by which such a belief could be shown to be false. Since this special creation view is impossible to falsify, it is not science at all, and the term creation science is an oxymoron. Myth 8. Scientists are particularly objective. Scientists are no different in their level of objectivity than are other professionals. They are careful in the analysis of evidence and in the procedures applied to arrive at conclusions. But contributions from both the philosophy of science and psychology reveal that there are at least three major reasons that make complete objectivity impossible. Many philosophers of science support the view that science can advance only through a string of conjectures and refutations. In other words, scientists should propose laws and theories as conjectures and then actively work to disprove or refute those ideas. The absence of contrary evidence, demonstrated through an active program of refutation, will provide the best support available. From a philosophical perspective, the idea is sound, but there are no indications that scientists actively practice programs to search for disconfirming evidence. Another aspect of the inability of scientists to be objective is found in theory-laden observation. Scientists, like all observers, hold a myriad of preconceptions and biases about the way the world operates. These notions affect everyone's ability to make observations. It is impossible to collect and interpret facts without any bias. This occurs not because of any fraud or deceit, but because of the prior knowledge possessed by the individual. Certain facts either were not seen at all or were deemed unimportant based on the scientist's prior knowledge. Related to the issue of theory-based observations is allegiance to the paradigm. The research tradition paradigm, shared by those working in a given discipline, provides clues to the questions worth investigating, dictates what evidence is admissible, and prescribes the tests and techniques that are reasonable. Although the paradigm provides direction to the research, it may also stifle or limit investigation. Anything that confines the research endeavor necessarily limits objectivity. While there is no conscious desire on the part of scientists to limit discussion, it is likely that some new ideas in science are rejected because of the paradigm issue. Ideas from outside the paradigm are liable to be eliminated from consideration as crackpot or poor science and thus do not appear in print. Myth 9. Experiments are the principal route to scientific knowledge. Many noteworthy scientists have used non-experimental techniques to advance knowledge. In fact, in a number of science disciplines, true experimentation is not possible because of the inability to control variables. Many fundamental discoveries in astronomy are based on extensive observations rather than experiments. Copernicus and Kepler changed our view of the solar system using observational evidence derived from lengthy and detailed observations, frequently contributed by other scientists, but neither performed experiments. Charles Darwin punctuated his career career with an investigatory regime more similar to qualitative techniques used in the social sciences than the experimental techniques commonly associated with the natural sciences. The techniques advanced by Darwin have been frequently used by scientists Goodall and Nossi in their primate studies. Scientific knowledge is gained in a variety of ways, including observation, analysis, speculation, library investigation, and experimentation. Myth 10. All work in science is reviewed to keep the process honest. Unfortunately, while such a check and balance system would be useful, the number of findings from one scientist checked by others is vanishingly small. In reality, most scientists are simply too busy and research funds too limited for this type of review. The result of the lack of oversight has recently put science itself under suspicion. With the pressures of academic tenure, personal competition, and funding, it is not surprising that instances of outright scientific fraud do occur. However, even without fraud, the enormous amount of original scientific research published, and the pressure to produce new information rather than reproduce others' work, dramatically increases the chance that errors will go unnoticed. An interesting corollary to this myth is that scientists rarely report valid but negative results. While this is understandable given the space limitations in scientific journals, the failure to report what did not work is a problem. Only when those working in a particular scientific discipline have access to all of the information regarding a phenomenon, both positive and negative, can the discipline progress.
Scientists are working on new and different ways to cure our ills and ease the pain of living our days. We're taking two steps back.
Mr. Science, can you help me please? Tell me what I need is an answer, an equation for the future. What I know is the fruitless mutants. Mr. Science, can you help me?
Appeared in Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Played by Rudolf Kleinroger, the scientist had unruly hair, a disabled hand, and obsessive research interests. He worked alone, and although he lived in a modern city that his inventions made function, he was like a 16th century alchemist. He dressed in medieval garb and lived in a little Gothic house amid the skyscrapers. The character took age-old myths about scientific knowledge, that it was the magical product of a shuttered monomaniac, and carried them over into a science fiction epic about
the future.
In literature, the classic story of the overreaching scientist was Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. It was first filmed in 1910 for Thomas Edison's studio. The creature became the monster, and the story had as much to do with Victorian melodrama as with Shelley's story. In the process, the complex original was turned into a simple parable about the dangers of too much knowledge, an updating of Goethe's Dr. Faustus. The first sound version of Frankenstein was James Whale's Hollywood film of 1931. Like its 1910 predecessor, it was about the dangers of playing God. The monster had a large cranium, a bolt through his neck, and surgical scars. In the novel, he had been described as beautiful. No more. The success of this film version led to an avalanche of imitations in the 1930s, often with medical themes.
Beep, beep.
The actual science practiced by mad scientists of the cinema changed over the years. In the 1920s, it was poison gas and death rays. In the 1930s, it was medicine. In the 1950s, it was nuclear physics. And since the 1980s, it has been genetic engineering. Each of these branches of science has mirrored public anxieties, but the stereotype of the scientist as mad, bad, and dangerous has remained surprisingly constant. In the 1933 animated short, The Mad Doctor, the scientist, clad in a white coat and rubber gloves and brandishing a carving knife, chases Mickey Mouse around the house before strapping him to the operating table. In 1957, the incredible shrinking man pitted a gigantic house cat against the film's shrinking hero. There have also been noble scientists at the cinema, the ones who were likely to attract the Best Actor awards for the performers portraying them. The story of Louis Pasteur led the way in the 1930s. Madame Curie followed in 1943. The latter film was unusual in that its central character was a woman, the physicist who discovered radium, and also because it turned Curie's life into a sentimental love story, Mrs. Miniver with test tubes. More recently, real scientists have been heroic mavericks fighting the bad guy scientific establishment so that their ideas will be taken seriously. The mavericks have eccentric research interests, they are more often women, and they win in the end. Ellie Arroway, the frumpy yet driven physicist of 1997's Contact, has to fight for every grant she gets, but ultimately makes the discovery of a lifetime. Contact with an alien life form. The scientist has become the hero, but only if he or she is an outsider. The realities of scientific research, teamwork, applications for funding, years of repetitive hard work, remain as remote as ever. When heroic scientists appear in films, the stories still present a negative image of science as a career. And more often, mad scientists continue to inhabit films, most often comedies and cartoons. In the 1996 movie, The Nutty Professor, Eddie Murphy played an updated version of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. The movie grossed more than $120 million at the box office, and a sequel, Nutty Professor 2, The Clumps, was released in 2000. Nah. In last year's animated feature, Wallace and Gromit in The Curse of the Were-Rabbit, the engineer Wallace is a stereotypical applied scientist, an eccentric who works in his potting shed on great inventions and is better at communicating with his dog Gromit than with human beings. He is cuddly and lovably nostalgic, but presents the sort of image that drives real-life engineers crazy. The film was an Academy Award nominee. What do cinematic images of scientists say about cultural attitudes toward scientific progress? They are usually about science as a source of anxiety, scientists as outsiders and oddballs, research as very likely to get into the wrong hands, and scientific institutions as dangerous places to be. Never mind that cinema depends on technological progress. This is one of the great unresolved contradictions of popular culture.
Boop, 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 boop.
is what is an alt-ty? The term alti describes people who are so militantly pro-alternative medicine and so distrustful of conventional medicine that they will never admit when conventional medicine is effective and refuse ever to concede that any alternative medical practitioner might, just might, possibly be a quack. Part and parcel of being an alti is an anti-intellectual and anti-scientific attitude that does not allow a little thing like evidence to sway one from one's belief in the power of alternative medicine. Could you be an alti? If you believe that doctors, scientists, and the pharmaceutical companies conspire to suppress your favorite alternative medicine modality, you just might be an alti. If you claim that science is a religion, you might be an alti. If you accept without questioning vague and poorly documented anecdotes and testimonials as sufficient evidence for you that an alternative therapy can produce remarkable results curing cancer, heart disease, autism, Alzheimer's, etc., but routinely brutally nitpick and then dismiss well-designed, randomized, double-blinded phase 3 clinical trials for conventional medicine, you just might be an alti. If you believe that megadoses of carrot juice can cure cancer,
you just might be an alti.
If you make claims for a product or therapy like strengthens the immune system, restores balance, detoxifies the liver, cleanses the colon, or cleanses the blood, you may be an alti. If you are impressed by such claims when made by others, you just might be an alti. If you believe that a chiropractor can manipulate your spine without touching you and cure your back pain, you're probably an alti. If you believe that a liver fluke can cause all diverse kinds of cancer out there and that zapping that fluke can cure all cancer and AIDS, you just might be an alti. If you absolutely positively cannot ever admit that a conventional therapy, any conventional medical therapy, can cure a disease, any disease, you may well be an alti. If you believe the trace of a dog's milk molecule diluted many times has more healing power than 875 milligrams of amoxicillin, you might be an alti. If you believe that it's perfectly logical that some alt-med clinic tucked away in a remote corner of some South American country has been able to achieve amazing cure rates for many unusually highly fatal cancers for years, all without publishing any data and without attracting the attention of any Western medical or science institutions or media whatsoever,
then you must be an alti.
If you call your backyard herb garden the pharmacy,
you might be an alti.
If you can go on and on for hours about how many people die from medical errors but become confused and defensive when someone mentions the victims of alternative medicine, you might be an alti. If you believe that there really are herbal cures for diabetes and cancer, but the government forbids their sale because pharmaceutical companies need to make money from their expensive drugs that don't work, there's a good chance that you're an alti. If you can look at a study that doesn't mention alternative medicine and that actually points out that its results should cast doubt on claims of miracle cures and still conclude that the study shows that alternative medicine can cure incurable cancers,
you're definitely an alti.
Finally, if you are deeply offended by any of the aforementioned items, you just might be an alti.
I had always resented the fact that in most superhero stories, or actually in most comic books, the hero is some sort of a rugged, muscular... And just to show that there's no reason why a hero couldn't also be a kid who likes science and is good in school and is smart. And that was the thinking behind it.
Signing off.
You're listening to WFMU East Orange, WXHD Mount Hope, and WFMU.org.